Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone. Welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks to the future and says, back to the howling old owl in the woods hunting the horny-backed toad. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
So, guys, we have a listener request to answer. We wanted, we invite our listeners at the end of every episode to send in any requests they might have for us to cover in the future, and this is one of those episodes. So first, we have to give a big thank you to Sylvia Ramsey, who wrote in and asked us to address a few things. And she was thinking of, I think, several different podcasts, but we kind of lumped them all into one in a way because they all seem to have a similar theme. So here is the request. I listen to the podcast all the time. Could we have some shows about the technologies used to be more self-reliant? For example, how electricity can be generated on a household level cheaply and sustainably. Or passive heating and cooling of the home. What are the new technologies to retrofit an older home to decrease energy use? Can I make fuel for my car at home? Do we have to use food crops to make ethanol? Also, I'd like to know a little more about regenerating soil that has been degraded by too much tilling or pesticides and fertilizer. Where you have no more remaining carbon and too much saline so that it will grow food again. So that's a lot of stuff, but it all kind of fits in this whole idea of self-reliance fits on this idea of getting off the grid, not relying on the things that that are provided by various companies and government agencies that make up what we think of as society, and becoming this more kind of self-reliant unit. And this could be something that takes place in the middle of a city. It could be one of those scenarios where you're saying, this is it, I'm going to be a hermit in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, you know, you have to start taking into consideration, how are you going to make this happen without too huge an impact on the life you are used to?
Why is it always the woods? Why can't you be a hermit in the desert or a hermit in the tundra?
You can be a hermit at either of those places. It's just getting at water is a lot more challenging in both cases.
What about a hermit in the sea?
A hermit on the fertile plains, I think, is probably the ultimate.
Yeah, hermit in the woods is actually pretty tough to carry out, too, especially if you want electricity.
Electrically speaking,
if you don't want electricity, it's easy. But electricity is a big problem. If you expect to have that in your life, then the woods may not be the best choice.
Well, first we should talk about why it is that people would want to be self-reliant and get off the grid, because it has taken our species hundreds of thousands of years to get on the grid. I have electricity, I have running water, I have communication services like telephone, internet. I have all these wonderful things. I have easy access to, you know, food that I don't have to grow myself. It makes life pretty easy. So what are the reasons people would have for wanting to disconnect from all of this convenience?
Well, I mean, we've got the whole self-reliance angle, this idea of being independent and not having to depend upon others. One of the big issues of this world that we live in is that a lot of people, in fact, I would argue most people, don't have the knowledge or skill sets necessary to survive without that system.
Mm-hmm.
No. So, we are not like Cormac McCarthy protagonists.
We're all the people who died before the story started.
Right. we don't have those survival skills, and we don't have the equipment we would need if the apocalypse came.
So part of it is just this idea of being self-reliant puts you in a better spot. Whether you think the worst could happen or you just think, This is something that's important to me.
From a philosophical standpoint, saying that I want to be able to do this. And furthermore, I'm not comfortable perhaps taking this much from the rest of society.
Right. Then you have the idea of the people who want privacy. Yes, the folks who value their privacy are obviously going to want to find ways to protect that as much as possible. Being on the grid means you're already giving up quite a bit of your privacy. Things like how much energy you use is going to be known, at least by the entity that's providing the energy.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of stuff.
I mean, also just where you live and how many people know that you're there and when you're there.
When you're using communication devices, mm-hmm. then that definitely starts to give a lot more information. The more you rely upon the grid, however you define that grid, not just power grid, but this social structure, then the less privacy you're going to have. And then, of course, some of us, a lot of us choose to give up a lot of privacy voluntarily. We share things on these communication systems.
A lot of us just don't think about it, you know.
Yeah.
you just kind of unconsciously give that information away.
Right, like saying things like, oh, I'm really looking forward to this vacation, and you're not thinking, hey, I've already made it clear where I live, and now I've also made it clear when I'm not going to be there,
right.
That kind of stuff. Then the next big category, I would say, and by the way, I'm not suggesting that any person only falls into one category or that the three categories I'm talking about are the only ones. I'm just kind of identifying the big ones that I can think of. But one would be just the environmentally conscious, the people who want to make as little an environmental impact, negative environmental impact, as they possibly can. And, you know, we all know that not all, but a lot of electricity, depending upon where you live, can come from sources that end up burning a lot of fossil fuels, which create a lot of greenhouse gases, big carbon footprint.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the costs of these grid conveniences like electricity.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big one, right? I mean, so it's...
In lucky cases, you might be getting some grid electricity from clean power.
Right.
Or relatively clean power, because as we talk about pretty frequently on this show, even something like getting solar energy from photovoltaics means that someone has to create the photovoltaic material,
right.
Which uses a lot of nasty chemicals.
Right. Or building a wind turbine also means that the manufacturing process usually has its own carbon footprint. It's one of those things where you start peeling back the layers and you realize that the big picture is a lot more complicated. Now, the actual production of energy from that point forward, much cleaner.
Sure.
Right.
And that's great.
Yeah. So what's the number one source of grid electricity in the United States? Well, it's our old friend coal.
Yeah.
Coal.
Yeah, coal. Coal generates about 44% of all the electricity in the United States.
Is that number as of 2009, I think?
I believe so. And,
yeah.
And even then you're looking at, you know, that's the largest of all the individual ones. So everything else makes up the rest. So
yeah.
It's less than half of all the energy, but still the largest single slice of the pie.
Yeah.
And it's also the source of 67% of the nation's sulfur dioxide emissions, 23% of nitrogen oxide emissions, and 40% of man-made carbon dioxide emissions, meaning it's the largest contributor to air pollution.
Right.
So overall. So there are other things like transportation that if you take transportation as a whole in the United States may produce more carbon dioxide than power plants. But when you look at all the pollutants across the board, power generation is the top. That's the biggest one.
Especially when you factor in things like heating and cooling.
Right. Mm-hmm. So getting off the grid, if you're able to generate your own electricity, presumably not through your own backyard coal power plant, you're not going to be impacting the environment negatively beyond whatever the initial carbon footprint was of whatever device you've decided to use.
Sure. There might also be the fact that the grid is producing electricity in a way that might not be the most efficient or convenient for you.
Yeah. In the United States in particular, we have, you know, there's this idea of the smart grid. It's a great idea. And there are some
places.
And then
there's the reality of the dumb grid.
Right, right. The smart grid is something that has been rolled out in certain areas, but it's not something that's infrastructure wide, right? The smart grid is this idea of not just is it delivering electricity, but it's doing it, it's able to dynamically change over time as conditions change. So it's not just a system that's constantly at 98% capacity. Like one of the stories you'll read about if you look into the power grids in the United States, so that most of them are almost at full capacity right now. And if something happens, if demand somehow changes, that can result in brownouts or blackouts. We've seen that happen multiple times, especially on the West Coast.
Sure.
But in the Northeast, not that long ago, a few years ago, there was a massive blackout in the Northeast as well. And it's not like we can dynamically route power easily through these systems. A smart grid would have much more flexibility. It also would allow for, if there was an interruption in service, often the companies don't know that there's an interruption in service unless customers start letting them know, calling them. But a smart grid would have the ability to let a utility company know if service had been interrupted at one point, and they could either reroute stuff to make the affected area as small as possible or immediately send out repair crews or both to address the situation.
Right. And there's another way that the self-reliance may come in. If you want to get off the grid, well, it might just be because, hey, I want to control my own production of energy. I don't want to have to call the power company and have them tell me, well, it'll be a few days.
Yeah, I would like it if it meant that power was lost to the entire region I live in, I still have power because I'm generating my own electricity. I'm not dependent upon some external resource. I mean, apart from whatever you're using to get your energy.
You like it until your neighbors come banging on your door to watch your TV.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Unless, of course, the blackout is so wide that you can't pick up anything.
And technically, if you were truly off the grid, you wouldn't have a television.
Maybe. I don't know.
You could have over the air. You could have an over the air like antenna and you pick up broadcasts over the air. That doesn't have any reflection. So you would just be able to pick stuff up. But even then, if it's a full blackout of the region, there aren't going to be any broadcast towers near enough to you to get to pick anything up.
I was kind of joking anyway.
Look, we all know you're trying to catch up on Game of Thrones.
And I'm glad that we nitpicked it to death in that case.
Yes, that's what we do here.
That's what we do.
We make a joke and then we drive it into the ground.
Let's pit more nits.
Okay. let's pick more nits.
No, pit more nits.
We'll pit more nits then.
Okay.
So Nick Fury.
Let's say you want to get off the grid. This idea appeals to you.
Yeah.
How would you do it? What are the steps you'd need to take and what are the factors you need to consider?
Well, all right, let's assume for the moment that you do want electricity. All right, because if you don't want electricity, then this simplifies things quite a bit. But let's assume that you need electricity for certain things. You have certain conveniences you're used to. Perhaps you still want to maintain some connection to the grid with communication devices, like you want to be able to communicate with loved ones who are still definitely part of society.
Mm-hmm. Or you really enjoy refrigeration.
Yep, that's another big one. If you don't have a plentiful fresh food source that's going to be available all year round, then you're going to need something to keep that food preserved. And perhaps you are not great at pickling everything. So, yeah, it'd be necessary. So, electricity is a big one. Well, you want to be able to generate it. If you're going to be off the grid, you're not going to be dependent upon any power grids out there. Probably the number one choice, I would say, would be solar.
Mm-hmm.
Now, solar power, of course, you're using solar panels, which we've discussed many times. If you're talking top of the line, super efficient solar panels, like the kind that are used in space, under ideal conditions, they top out at about 40% efficiency, meaning 60% of the energy hitting them gets lost. If you're talking about the kind that we could actually use in our homes, because those are reserved for like space stuff.
And those optimal conditions really only happen in the laboratory.
And it would be prohibitively expensive for pretty much any human being apart from billionaires.
Well, I mean, solar power is still pretty expensive.
Yeah. The initial expense that's the big problem with any of these is that you have to make an initial investment. Now, over time, you're going to save tons of money because you don't have to pay any utility bills. You have to maintain whatever it is you're using. But if you're using regular solar panels, the kind that most of us would be able to get for our homes, that efficiency peaks out around 20 or 21%. On top of that, each solar panel is only generating a little bit of electricity, so you got to have a lot of them in order to get enough power.
It affects the locations you can choose for where you want to live.
Right.
Because you don't want to be somewhere that's cloudy or has tree cover.
Or you don't want to be too far north.
Right.
You know, because they're going to be
long. The days get shorter.
Yeah, there's long stretches of time where you're not going to get a lot of daylight. So the closer to the equator you are, the more sun you're going to get year round. Because otherwise, there are going to be sections of the year where you're not going to have very much electricity at all. You're also going to want batteries, because otherwise you're not going to be able to use any electricity after the sun goes down.
Which is when many of us want light.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it turns out that turning all your lights on when it's already bright outside is not necessarily the most, effective thing. In fact, you would probably be using things like daylighting, which is where you're using either a series of windows or even
advanced
windows.
Advanced window technology.
It kind of is. There's actually, I've seen a really cool one where you use like a kind of like a skylight that's installed in the house, and then it uses a tunnel system with mirrors to direct that sunlight down to whatever room you want. So it's like having a light that's dictated by the sun. So you still get light in the daytime, and then you only use the electricity at night when you don't have that daylight.
I think in a lot of cases, whatever your source is, it's going to involve a lot of cutting back on the electricity you use.
Yes. You want to be very, very efficient. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. But the point being that, you have to be strategic in where you're going to live so that you can make the most out of the sunlight you're going to get. And you have to be strategic about how you're going to use it and how you're going to store it. But there are other choices as well, not just solar power.
Ed Begley's stationary bicycle home power.
You could actually I didn't put it in my notes, but yeah, you could actually have things in there where you're using human power to generate some electricity, although it's small
amounts.
I
cannot imagine that would be appreciable amounts of electricity.
It wouldn't be enough to power anything really significant, but you could use it to help charge a battery or something.
If you really need to work out anyway, it's a pretty good way to charge your cell phone.
But
if you're using a cell phone.
Right. It's more likely that you would use something like wind power. You could get wind turbines that you can use at your home. There are a lot of places that allow that. They have very, most areas in the United States have specific restrictions on how tall those things can be and how close they can be.
And it certainly depends also on whether you live in a residential area or somewhere rural or et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
Because, just your homeowners association, if you own a home, for example, might have a problem with you erecting a large
50-foot
windmill.
Tall tower that's behind your house. So,
what about nuclear power?
Also not practical. So getting back to things that actually could happen, the wind power, another issue there is that you'd have to be someplace where you're getting consistent winds.
Yeah.
So some places are less conducive to that than others. Like if you happen to live near a coast, then that's awesome because you're going to be getting pretty consistent winds in one direction during the day and another direction at night. But not every place gets, great wind coverage either. Then you could have micro hydropower. Micro hydropower being that it's kind of a tiny version of the stuff you would see at, say, the Hoover Dam. That would be macro hydropower.
Huh. Right.
But, so if you're living next to a stream or a river or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they look kind of, some of them look like little outboard motors without a boat.
Right.
They just sit in the water and the water turns a turbine. And
right. And that generates the electricity, which can then charge battery packs, which you use to access power. You would have to have some sort of inverter to switch DC to AC, that kind of stuff. But, this is also a possibility. I've seen some where, it's a man-made trough that branches off of a natural stream. And that's what ends up feeding the turbine or turning the turbine. I shouldn't say feeding, but turning it. So again, all of these mean that you have to be strategic in where you place your domicile. So if you're talking about retrofitting an existing house, obviously you're limited by whatever geographic features happen to be in that area. You can make some, depending upon where you are and homeowners associations, because some would say, no, you can't put solar panels on top of your house. We're not going to allow it.
And some cities won't either.
Yeah. But if, assuming that they do, then.
Actually, I'm not sure if that's, always check your local regulations.
Yeah. Right. I think it depends neighborhood to neighborhood, actually.
Sure.
But yeah, there are also some cities that will allow you to not only use solar panels, but if you generate more electricity than you actually need and you're still on the grid, like you're not using this to get off the grid. You're using it to
supplement what is coming in.
Mm-hmm. If you actually generate more than what you need, some cities will allow you to sell that extra electricity back to the grid.
Right. Depending on whether the systems that you're using are compatible with the local.
Yeah. There are a lot of caveats, a lot of qualifiers.
I'm often on the grid.
Yeah. You know, me and the grid, we got a thing. We have an understanding. At any of these considerations, you can potentially used to retrofit a home, again, dependent upon the geographic and legal situation of that home.
Okay, micro hydropower, that makes me think about water. We actually also get our water from a grid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's most of us are reliant, there are actually quite a few homes in the United States that have wells, that use wells for water. But if you're living
in over 15 million households in the United States.
Lots of them. But if you happen to live in, say, an urban area, like we live in Atlanta, so we're getting our water from
the municipal system.
So, but yeah, we have reservoirs of water. We have these water towers, which allow us to use the force of gravity to help provide water pressure.
And water mains and piping systems.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you don't want to be part of that, if you're saying I'm being really self-reliant, I'm not going to be on the water system, then you've got to be, you either have to be close to like a lake or a stream or something like that where you're getting your water directly from there, or more likely what you're going to do is drill a well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, wells are going to depend on, depending on the location, you may have to drill Well, first of all, you have to get someone who's truly a licensed well driller, because this is not fooling around. You don't want to do this yourself.
No.
Unless you happen to be a licensed well driller, in which case you can do it yourself. It tends to run, from my, the last time I looked, between $3,000 and $15,000, depending upon how deep a well you need to drill.
And how complicated the job is going to be, because there's really a lot to consider if you're going to do this whole well thing. The location, any potential contaminant and disease testing, and purification of the water that you're getting out, because so much stuff gets into groundwater that you might not be thinking about before you just go get a delicious cup of death.
Yeah, if you happen to be really far from everything, then that might not be an issue, but... You know, the rest of us would have to take that into consideration.
I mean, we bury trash in landfills. Septic tanks can leak. Fuels are stored in underground tanks. We use all kinds of fertilizers and pesticides. Industrial and urban area runoff can cause all kinds of third eyes.
Yeah. Just think about all the homeopathic medicine you'd get from
Let's
that
not do that. Really? Come on. Don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry. You don't like me when I'm not angry, Joe. You're not going to like me when I am angry.
You might also be able to supplement this with rain collection.
Yes, you can use cisterns to help collect rain. Usually you're using this where the gutters will end up, all the runoff will go into a cistern, which then can be pumped into a home. Either pumped, or if the cistern's on top of the home, gravity can help create the water pressure necessary for it to be circulated into the home for use. Cisterns also, if you're using those, you have to worry about things like what your roof is made of, because some roofing material uses chemicals that could be dangerous to people. So you don't really necessarily want to use regular roofing tiles. You would have to probably look into something else that doesn't have that toxicity to it that could potentially leach into your water supply. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that would be a big issue. But either way, you know, you're drilling a well using cisterns or a combination of the two, that would get you off the grid as far as water is concerned. It would be, again, another one of those where you have an initial expense up front, but then in the long run, you end up saving money, assuming that you do pay for water.
Sure. The other half of that, though, is the septic system. You're going to need some kind of system to dispose of your wastewater.
Yep.
And the way that a septic system works, essentially, is that bacteria in the tank break down the waste and then release it via pipes into a drain field where the soil will further break it down. But yeah, that's pretty important, because otherwise...
And you still have to have someone come out and empty it about once a year.
And,
even right. with that, because even though it's distributing stuff through this drain pipe system, it's still accumulating waste that's not going to go through those drain pipes, and that you have to have someone come out and empty it out. I lived in rural Georgia in a house that had a septic tank, so mm-hmm. I remember distinctly the experience of having the crew come out and pop the lid and pump it out. And
it's memorable.
Yeah. No, I also live near a paper mill and a major poultry farm. So you know how they say that the sense of smell is really connected to memory? Yeah. I got some bad smell memories, y'all. That's just it builds character. But yes, a good point, though, that you do have to think about where does the wastewater go. You can't just, you know, dump that back out either. That's not environmentally friendly either.
Especially not if you've got a well, because then you're contaminating your
own
water source.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then, of course, you want to find ways to conserve water, just like you want to find ways to conserve electricity, since, you know, you're going to be generating your own. You want to make sure that you're using water wisely and that you're not wasting it in various ways. I mean, I've heard about people who will conserve water so far as to, like, if they're taking a shower and they're starting to shampoo their hair, which I hear is something people do. It's been a long time for me. But that they'll actually turn the water off while they're lathering the shampoo,
sure.
And then turn it back on to rinse it all out and that kind
of
stuff.
Yeah. Or, you know, collecting what's called gray water, you know, basically okay water to put back out over your garden or something
Right. So that might be something like the water that drains from your sink would go into this gray water, which you could then use to water plants.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, it's obviously, again, one of those important parts where you want to conserve as much as you can. Now let's talk about heating and cooling, because unless you happen to live in a magical land where the temperature is always a comfortable ambient, I don't know, what's comfortable for you guys? I know what's comfortable for me. But let's say it's like 68 degrees year round, which might be a little on the chilly side for some of you.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy at like 76.
Wow. No, too warm. Too warm. But yeah, unless you happen to live in some place that's magical, that's that temperature all the time.
You mean San Diego?
Yeah. San Diego when it's not on fire, then you would probably need to have some form of system to heat and or cool your house so that in the winter you don't get too cold and summer you don't get too hot. There are ways of doing that without using gas or electricity. Their effectiveness depends upon where your home is located. But for example, the passive heating systems all involve things like the materials that your home is made of, the orientation your home is in relation to how the sunlight hits it.
Right. So there's this concept of passive solar construction. And the way this works to take advantage of heating and cooling is that you build your house in such a way with relationship to the path of the sun during the different seasons that you're getting direct sunlight coming through the passive windows in the winter to produce a greenhouse effect within the house. So the
maximizing
light,
the heat.
Yeah. The light comes through the windows, turns into heat, and then is trapped within. But then the house is built in such a way that during the summer, the angle of the sun will be blocked by an opaque area that doesn't allow the sunlight to pass directly through.
So like either an opaque area on the window itself or an awning of some sort, something like that.
Right. It could be either one. You could design the windows in such a way that sunlight coming at a certain angle doesn't pass through as easily.
Right. So yeah, that would be a really helpful system. There are other things besides, like, you know, an air conditioning system, a full HVAC system takes a lot of power.
Oh, yeah.
So that's probably way too much for your average, like, solar-powered home.
Well, if you're talking about efficiency in the home, heating and cooling, just those two things are a huge fraction of the total energy we use. And
right.
If we just got rid of that, that would already make a huge dent in what you need.
And, in fact, there are a lot of things you can do just again, with the retrofitting of homes, there are a lot of things you can do that will really drastically affect that, like making sure you have really good insulation.
Right.
That is a huge, huge factor. So
it seems obvious, but yeah, the basic materials, the amount of insulation, the quality of the insulation, and even the paint colors that you're using can make a very large difference.
Whether or not your windows are properly treated so that they are sealed well, that kind of stuff. These are things that you can do to any home, whether you're building a new one or you're retrofitting an old one, that can dramatically impact the amount of power you need to for climate control. Now, one of the other things I was going to mention on here that's an alternative to a traditional air conditioning system is what some people call a swamp cooler. It's called a swamp cooler because it's using water to help take heat out of the atmosphere. The idea is that you have a device that has some material that's got water soaked in it. Yeah, it's soaked in water in some way. You use a fan to blow air from outside through this thing. The warm air makes contact with the water material, the material soaked in water, and heat from the air ends up evaporating some of the water, and that means that the air itself loses heat, so it becomes cooler. So the air that ends up blowing into your home is cooler than the ambient temperature of the air.
Mm-hmm.
So you get this overall cooling effect. However, this only works if you are in a place that has a relatively dry environment. If you're
living in Atlanta,
it does not work. Not at all.
Right. The air already has too much moisture in it to really put this to good use.
Yeah. No, we already have too much humidity. The air is pretty much saturated with humidity. So it's not an effective way of cooling. I mean, you could just as well just put a regular fan inside a house and just have air blowing around, and that circulation might help some, but it doesn't necessarily make the air feel cooler. Same thing with a swamp cooler if you happen to live in a high humidity area, but that's another alternative.
So I've got kind of a big one now.
Okay.
What about data and communication services?
All right. So if you are able to go outside and shout, and everyone you need to talk to can hear you and shout back and you can hear them, you're set. Otherwise, this is a problem. Because communication by its very nature requires that there be some sort of system there for it to work. If you're talking about anything beyond, you know, line of sight.
Yeah.
Or like, I mean, I guess a ham radio or something. But
yeah, well, even then you got to have the, well, yes, you could do a ham radio, I guess, but even then, that's long distance. Anyone could listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a party line.
I guess this sort of depends on whether you, like, what your reasoning is for wanting to get off the grid. If it's something about privacy, you just might not want to have these services.
Right, because anytime you're going to use an electronic device that is used for communication, there by its nature, there needs to be something that identifies that device so that other information, other communication can get back to you. Otherwise, all you've got is something that allows you to broadcast but not receive.
Oh, well, and in the case of the internet, there are more and less secure and private ways to browse the net and to
sure.
talk to people.
If you're using the Tor browser, for mm-hmm. example, that gives you a little more privacy. Although we did an episode of Tech Stuff about the Tor routing network and the browsers used to access it. And as we pointed out in that episode, that's using it is not enough. Like, you have to go well above and beyond that if you truly want to reduce the data footprint you're leaving behind that identifies who you are. You have to go to some pretty extreme measures in order to really ensure that happens. But assuming that's not your goal, if communication, if privacy is not the thing you're worried about, then, you know, it's less of a problem. You could have something like a cell phone, and assuming you have cell phone service wherever you've decided to erect your magical house, then you should be fine. Again, assuming, of course, that you're also generating electricity, because I'm guessing your cell phone is running on it.
Yeah, or you could just go with a wireless internet service provider.
Yeah. 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 There's some that use cellular networks,
yeah.
essentially, to use that, you know, and you just use a dongle or some other kind of modem-like device, router-like device to get access to it. So, yeah, if privacy is not the reason why you've decided to, you know, cut all ties to the grid, then that would be one of the routes I would go. Yeah.
I've got a question.
Okay.
Let's say I'm living in a house off the grid and Jonathan comes over with his huge collection of original Star Wars action figures in the original packaging. And I just start tearing them open, of course, because I want to play with the toys.
You're a terrible friend.
What do I do with all of the original packaging? Where do I put all that?
Joe, that's not going to be a consideration you need to make, because I will have killed you and hollowed out your body for use as a sleeping bag, Tauntaun style. It's the only fitting way for the horrible thing you've done to my
See, but if
box.
I do that at my house, the garbage people will come and pick them up and take them away as long as they're in one of the
right.
designated bags.
Right. Okay, so we're saying, like, what if your house is not anywhere near some place where you have this kind of the service, right?
Or what if you're choosing not to use it?
Not to use it. Okay. So, all right. Well, you've got some choices. First of all, you want to reduce the amount of stuff you have to throw away to the absolute bare minimum.
Which means that you're going to be thinking a lot harder about the things that you're purchasing, assuming that you are purchasing things still from outside sources.
Right. So you want to be able to do the three R's, right? Reduce, reuse, recycle. So you want to reduce as much of the stuff that would necessarily be thrown away eventually as much as possible. Keep in mind, like, if you're generating your own electricity, you're going to have batteries, and eventually you're going to have to replace batteries. So mm-hmm. that's one of those things that you got to remember. You know, like, batteries do not last forever. Solar panels, same thing. You're going to have to replace those at some point.
And some electronics like that can, in fact, be recycled.
Yeah. So there's the recycling part of, mm-hmm. you know, making sure you can recycle as much as you can.
Or, buying things in glass jars that you can reuse rather than in a plastic container.
I reuse a lot of glass jars.
Mm-hmm.
It is nearly impossible to live without producing any waste, but you can definitely cut way down.
And you can uh-huh. do composting to take care of organic stuff so that you can compost it down. And that's a big help, too.
Mm-hmm. And a great resource for your garden.
Yeah. Some stuff you would probably have to eventually, you know, haul out to a dump of some sort, because you're just not going to get around it. There's going to be some stuff that you cannot recycle or reuse. But if you can reduce that to the bare minimum, then you will dramatically decrease the impact you have environmentally speaking. So, that's what I'd tell anyone who is thinking about this.
Okay, what about Sylvia's questions?
Okay, yeah, she asked about ethanol. Like, does that necessarily have to come from food crops? And the answer to that is no. It does not have to necessarily come from food crops. There have been experiments using switchgrass, which most people think of as kind of a irritating plant that otherwise has no use. But in fact, you can use switchgrass to create ethanol. And a U.S. government study found that switchgrass could provide as many as 1,150 gallons of ethanol per acre per year. And that's actually way better than, say, corn, which is technically that's the most popular crop used to make ethanol.
Well, it's a popular crop in America.
Yeah.
Yes.
And a large amount of it is being used for biofuels.
Although I do want to put in that frequently the type of corn that is used in biofuels is either corn waste or a non-edible, not non-human edible form.
Yeah,
well,
I mean, you don't have to worry about making the corn nice and juicy because all you're doing is turning it into fuel.
Right.
So,
do they make it out of the baby corn? Because people shouldn't be eating that.
No, I can show you this whole video about how they package baby corn, though.
We watched a baby corn industrial video.
It's essentially
other day.
Made of terror.
Yeah. So, at any rate, if you're talking about corn, the average bushel size in 2012 would yield closer to 440 gallons per year. So, or bushel size, like per acre, like if we're looking at an acreage thing. So 1,150 gallons of ethanol versus 440 gallons per year corn. I mean, that's obviously a big difference. But even if you could grow this yourself, like she
like
also
grow
asked.
Grow enough to be useful.
She asked about the ability to make fuel for your car at home. Clearly, even if you were able to grow, like you have an acre of land, let's say, and you've dedicated it to growing switchgrass, you might be able to grow plenty of switchgrass to fuel that car, but you've got to process that switchgrass. You have to turn it into biofuel.
That's a pretty intense biochemical engineering related process.
Yeah, it's not something that you can, you know, you don't just put it in a pot of water and boil it for like 5 minutes and then you got fuel. So
yeah, but of course something like corn to ethanol or switchgrass to ethanol are not the only ways to create biofuels. You can create biodiesel out of algae. You can
create it out of cooking oil.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now most engines are not tuned, even diesel engines, because you have to have a diesel engine, by the way. Don't put this in a gasoline powered vehicle. But diesel engines can, some of them run on essentially what used cooking oil. So you'll hear about people who kind of, I remember a guy in Athens who was doing this where he would go around to restaurants and collect their used cooking oil and use that in his converted vehicle that used this as biodiesel for his engine. So the issue there is that not all engines are very well tuned for this. It could require lots more maintenance, a lot more cleaning in order for it to work, but it's potentially something you could do.
Yeah, there's a coalition of dairy farmers in Vermont who work with their local utility companies to process their cow's waste and use the methane gas to produce energy.
Yeah, that reminds me of Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. Bartertown ran on something similar. Then you had the question about soil regeneration. This idea of when it's a problem that a lot of farmers have run into, where the topsoil that they depend upon, that's the layer where stuff actually grows, is eroded either by weather or through using grazing lands improperly, that kind of thing, and you end up with desertification. Things turns into a desert. So how do you reverse that process? And there's not a cookie cutter approach to fixing this, because the problems tend to vary depending upon each situation. I read an interesting series of case studies that were done in Australia in 2012, where they, I think it was 19 different cases of people using different approaches because their situations were different enough where it merited it. Some things involved breaking up the ground a bit so that you had more facets that were exposed to the air that would actually help encourage organisms to grow again within the soil. Some of them involved introducing certain types of plants to help create that topsoil, or rotating crops through. That was another big one. Changing the grazing patterns of cattle, because it's Australia, so almost all of them were cattle farmers. Changing the kind of fertilizers they were using so that they were relying more on organic fertilizer rather than non-organic. All these things were ways to regenerate the soil so that it could actually grow the right kinds of plants, whether that was just grazing material for the animals or whether it was crops, like a lot of them were legumes, as I recall. So if you're able to do this, and you're able to reverse this process, you can start to get into this natural cycle, this self-regenerating cycle, which is what you would typically see in nature assuming there's not some other kind of climate change going on, if you're just looking at how the topsoil gets replenished over time just through the natural process of things dying off and breaking down into soil, you can actually get back into that cycle. But at least initially, it requires a lot of management because you actually have to reverse the process of turning into a desert. So there are other things. If you wanted to reduce the saline content, it usually means that you have to introduce a lot more water. So that's a big consideration, too. Where are you getting that water from? None of these solutions are necessarily very easy or inexpensive. They could be very expensive to implement, but ultimately, especially in the long run, they're beneficial. So you have to look at the long-term benefits versus the short-term setbacks. And then, of course, there's the idea about, you know, retrofitting homes. There's lots of technology out there to help you cut back on the amount of electricity you're consuming. And we talked about cutting back that heating and cooling, which is that's a huge chunk, mm-hmm. right?
And all of those smart...
The smart meters. Yeah,
right?
Smart meters, that's great because a smart meter allows you to really keep an eye on how much electricity you are consuming on a day-to-day basis. You know, most of us don't, you know, I don't know about you guys. I know that my home has an old-style power meter on there, and I don't go and look at it every day. And even if I did, I probably wouldn't be able to make heads or tails of what was going on. But smart meters give lots more information and, in fact, can even hook into an account that you have where you can monitor the account online if you wanted to. So you're not having to go out and look at some external meter. You could just pop online, check a web page and see. And you could actually monitor how much electricity you're using and be able to determine what is causing any sort of spikes. Another good thing is to use like major appliances like a washing machine or a dishwasher at night as opposed to daytime. When
it's off-peak hours.
Off-peak hours, exactly. Another good thing is to get the Energy Star appliances, which use less electricity. They have to actually go through a certification process that proves that they are energy efficient.
Using smart thermostats, like the Nest system is the big popular one right now.
Right. So that way you're not trying to cool your home to that 68 degrees that I like so much when you're not there. Lots of things like that are ways of helping. Also, just those different power strips you can get where when you switch the power switch off, it won't allow devices to sip vampire power. Vampire power is when you turn a device off, but it's still draining electricity. It's still got to pull a load on your electrical circuits, which means that you are spending money just by having your stuff turned off. If you have these power strips that actually cut that off, then you don't have to worry about that. So that's another thing to look into. And in a lot of ways, you might say this is kind of nickel and diming in cases like if you're already pretty careful, but really every little bit counts and it adds up over time. And not only that, again, if you know that your house, let's say, is getting electricity from a coal power plant and you don't have the option of investing in some renewable energy source, maybe that's just not an option for you based upon homeowners associations or the financial burden, then these other methods may be the best way for you to reduce your carbon footprint in a responsible way that doesn't impact your life so drastically.
So thank you so much to Sylvia for sending us this terrific list of questions. And I know that we kind of glossed through a bunch of them. So if anyone would like to hear something more in depth about any of these last few topics that we kind of summarized, didn't go too in depth with, you guys let us know.
Yeah. If there's something like you thought, well, that was really interesting, but you didn't go nearly deep enough, let us know. We can do a full episode on it.
Yeah. And we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah. And, so follow Sylvia's example, guys. Write us. You can send us an email. Our address is fwthinking@discovery.com or drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Google+. Our handle at all three of those is fwthinking. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.